Chapter 6 Sweatshops. In 2005, I was contacted by two filmmakers, Jim Keady and Leslie Kretzu. They requested an on-camera interview with me. Talking over the phone and through emails with them, I concluded that they were the antithesis of EHMs and represented a new wave of activists. In addition to interviewing you, we want you to know about Indonesia's sweatshops, Leslie told me when we finally got together. She briefly explained that in 2000 they had lived with Nike factory workers in Indonesia, under the same terrible conditions, surviving on the same wages or at least trying to. I asked what had motivated them to do it. It seems so long ago, Leslie said. I joined the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. They warned me that I'd never be the same. Their motto is JVC, ruined for life. I saw things I couldn't believe, poverty and suffering. I guess I was ruined for life. Then I worked with Mother Teresa's folks in India. I wanted to help her poorest of the poor. Once you've lived with people like that, you can never be the same, never return to your old ways, never forget. You simply have to do something. I looked at Jim. I was kidnapped by God, he said, laughing. Sounds funny, but I'm absolutely serious. When I was in high school, I thought I would go to Wall Street, make millions, and retire by 35. Then I took a trip around the world in 1993. I was 21. I visited developing countries for the first time. Indonesia, Laos, Vietnam, Burma, Nepal, to name a few. I saw real poverty. It contextualized the 16 years of Catholic school teachings I had received, including a BS from St. Joseph's University. I now understood who Jesus was fighting for. It was the beginning of my commitment to fight for the same things. Not just Jesus, of course, but also the Prophet Muhammad, the prophets in the Jewish tradition, the Buddha, and every other revered spiritual figure. In fact, all of the world's major religions have social justice at their core. I asked them to summarize their story in writing. We started paying attention to Nike's labor practices back in 1998, when Jim was an assistant soccer coach at St. John's University in New York City. He was studying for a master's degree in theology while coaching and decided for a paper topic to examine Nike's labor practices in light of Catholic social teaching. As he started his research, the athletic department at St. John's University began to negotiate a $3.5 million endorsement deal with Nike that would require all coaches and athletes to wear and promote Nike products. He first said privately, then publicly, that as a matter of conscience, he did not want to be a walking advertisement for a company with alleged sweatshop labor practices. At one of the largest Catholic universities in the country, he was given an ultimatum: wear Nike and stop questioning the deal or resign. In June 1998, he was forced to resign. Jim wanted to be 100% sure of his position, so he asked Nike if he could work in one of their factories for a month to get a sense of the conditions. Nike said that 1 month wouldn't be long enough, that he didn't speak any Southeast Asian languages, and that he would displace a worker. Jim wrote back that if 1 month wasn't long enough, he'd go for 6 months or a year, however long it would take, to get a sense of the working conditions and determine whether or not these were sweatshop jobs. He pointed out that since he spoke Spanish, Nike could send him to a factory in Central America. And for the worker he displaced, Jim found the nonprofit in Oregon, where Nike headquarters are based, that agreed to fly the worker to the U.S. and give him or her a room, board, and living stipend, essentially a vacation for the duration of the time Jim took over the job. Nike wrote back saying that they weren't interested in his offer. Because Jim could not work in a Nike factory, we decided to do the only thing we could think of as an alternative: to live with workers in their village, and economically restrict ourselves to the wages that they are paid. So in 2000, we went to Tangerang, Indonesia, outside Jakarta, to live with Nike factory workers on their basic wage, $1.25 a day. In 1 month, Leslie lost 15 pounds and Jim lost 25 pounds. Like Nike's workers, we lived in a small 9x9 cement box with no furniture and no air conditioning in this steaming tropical city. We slept on thin mats on an uneven cement floor covered in shelf paper. which had a constant layer of ash and grit from the burning garbage, factory pollution, and car exhaust fumes. The toilets drained into open sewers on both sides of every street. Because of the sewers, the village was infested with fist-sized cockroaches and the biggest rats we'd ever seen. Some people say to us, "You can live like a king on $1.25 a day in a place like Indonesia." It's a statement filled with apathy and misinformation. Most who make such claims have never even been to Indonesia. For $1.25, we were able to buy two small meals of rice and vegetables and a couple of bananas. If we wanted soap or toothpaste, we had to eat less food. One day Jim knocked over the kerosene for our small portable stove while cleaning, and we had to use our laundry soap to clean up the mess. It was a disaster, devastating financially and therefore emotionally as well. Try on these shoes. You are a 20-something adult working 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Saturday and sometimes Sunday. That doesn't include travel time or preparing yourself for work. You don't have the money to celebrate a friend's birthday. You can't afford a radio or even think about a television. You haven't bought yourself something new to wear in over 2 years. When you get home at the end of the day, you have to spend 30 to 45 minutes doing your laundry by hand. You don't have many clothes, and whatever you wear is visibly dirty at the end of the day. If you're a woman, when you menstruate, you still get only the allotted 2 bathroom breaks per day allowed to everyone. So you have to tie a scarf around your waist or wear a long shirt to cover the bloodstains on your pants. You're exhausted. You can feel the tired in your bones. You're afraid that if you speak up, you'll lose your job. And the multinational company you work for is telling the world that they've made serious changes and consumers need not worry. You're 100% happy. Unfortunately, it wasn't just Nike workers who lived in these conditions and on these wages. We spoke to people producing for Adidas, Reebok, The Gap, Old Navy, Tommy Hilfiger, Polo Ralph Lauren, Lotto, Fila, and Levi's. All earned the same poverty wages, lived in the same type of slums, and had the same requests of their corporate buyers. Give us higher wages and the freedom to organize independent unions. Nike workers were living degraded, unhealthy lives, ones most people from the United States cannot imagine. But wealthy Indonesians, along with foreigners, enjoyed the good life. When I was in EHM, there was one hotel in Jakarta that was the place where people like me stayed, the Intercontinental Indonesia. Today, the vast selection includes a Four Seasons, Marriott, Hyatt, Hilton, Crown Plaza, Sheraton, Mandarin, Le Meridian, Millennium, Ritz-Carlton, and a number of others. These are the homes away from home for U.S. corporate executives, where they wine and dine their Indonesian underlings and clients. From their rooms high above the city, they can look out toward Tangerang and the other suburbs where the city's workers live. They may try to deny culpability by pointing out that their companies do not own the factories, but they must feel the terrible guilt that comes from the deeper understanding that they are responsible. Nike squeezes the factory owners mercilessly, Jim said. Nike's people know the cost of producing every shoelace and sole, to the penny. They push and push, forcing the owners to keep the costs at a bare minimum. In the end, the factory owner, often Chinese, is compelled to accept a very small profit. The owners are a lot better off than the workers, Leslie said, sighing. But they too are exploited. Nike calls the shots and pockets the dough. We zero in on Nike, Jim explained, because it's the industry leader, has a much greater market share than all its competitors. It sets the pace. If we can force Nike to do better, everyone else will follow. Another aspect of progress in Indonesia is experienced by the corporate executives every time they step out of one of their luxury hotels. The Bechas are gone. Those bicycle cabs festooned with fanciful murals were banned from Jakarta's main streets in 1994. President Suharto claimed they symbolized a backward country. Unfortunately, his decision relegated tens of thousands of drivers to the ranks of the unemployed. The visitor will instead be assaulted by Bajaj, small motorized three-wheeled scooter taxis, enclosed in orange metal shells. Developed originally for India by Vespa, the Bajaj, according to Suharto, represented modernization. It is noisy, polluting, hot, and dangerous. Unlike the Bechas, Bajaj are all identical, the brilliant rainbow-colored paintings replaced by ubiquitous orange. An estimated 20,000 now clog the capital streets. Most Bechak drivers never received the training necessary to operate a Bajaj. Many also work in sweatshops. One U.S. administration after another supported Suharto's dictatorship. However, the Jakarta government came under harsh criticism from NGOs. Watchdog organizations condemned its serious violations of international and local laws, its human rights abuses, and its willingness to sacrifice democratic principles in order to satisfy multinational corporations and members of the president's inner circle. The New York Times stated that Indonesia regularly ranks among the world's most corrupt countries in international surveys. "I can't believe how bad things got," Neil, a former CIA operative, told me. He attended one of my book signings, lingered afterward, and offered to buy me a beer. We spent several hours talking into the night. We met again several months later when I visited my in-laws near San Francisco. He had joined the CIA because his Chinese parents raised him to hate Mao. "I was idealistic when I was stationed in Jakarta. It was 81. I believed we had to keep the commies out of Indonesia." He became disillusioned during the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989, feeling that it would turn people around the world against the United States. He retired from government work shortly afterward and went into private practice. Eventually, in 2005, he returned to Indonesia to head up a security team guarding tsunami reconstruction efforts against freedom fighters in Aceh province. "My God, this last trip was an eye-opener. Jakarta looks like a big modern city, sparkling skyscrapers, luxury hotels, but beneath the surface, things are worse than ever. Corruption's rampant, and we do the corrupting." When I asked why, after quitting the CIA, he continued in a similar profession, he answered, "It's all I know. A living." Then the second reason that, like the first, I hear often from jackals. "Besides, there's no substitute for the high you get. Skydivers and motorcycle racers do it for the rush, but that's nothing compared to facing a man who wants to kill you." Statements like that send chills along my spine. I think about my dad and other World War II heroes. How would they feel to know that our corporations and government encourage men to become addicted to killing for killing's sake? In writing Confessions, I wrestled with the horrible guilt of what I had done. Now, I was discovering that the consequences were more tragic than even I had imagined. Chapter 7. United States Supported Slaughter. Some of the worst Indonesian human rights and environmental violations began in East Timor about the time I was living in Ujung Pandang. Like Sulawesi, East Timor was a remote island that was considered to be rich in oil and gas deposits, in addition to gold and manganese. Unlike Sulawesi, which was part of Indonesia, East Timor had been governed by the Portuguese for four centuries. While 90% of Indonesians were Muslims, East Timor was predominantly Roman Catholic. East Timor declared itself independent from Portugal on November 28, 1975. 9 days later, Indonesia invaded. The brutal occupation forces slaughtered an estimated 200,000 people, one-third of the population of East Timor. Documents released by the National Security Archive establish that the U.S. government not only supplied the weapons used in the massacre, but also explicitly approved the invasion. According to these records, President Gerald Ford and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger met with Suharto on December 6, 1975, and agreed with his planned attack, which was launched the next day. The documents also reveal that the Carter administration blocked declassification of this information in 1977. João Carrascalau, brother of the former governor of East Timor and a political leader now in exile, was interviewed by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, 35 years to the day after the invasion. He stated, "I arrived at Jakarta 1 hour before President Ford and Henry Kissinger landed in Jakarta. And on the same night, I was informed by Colonel Suyanto, he was the top officer in the Jakarta administration, that America had given the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor." Brad Simpson, assistant professor of history at the University of Maryland and research assistant to the National Security Archive, told Amy, "These documents lay out a 25-year pattern of deceit by successive U.S. administrations. Keeping the details of Indonesia's planned invasion of East Timor from the American public and from the international community, systematically suppressing or discounting credible reports of massacres taking place in East Timor through the mid-1980s, and working to circumvent possible congressional bans on military systems to keep the pipeline of weapons flowing." 20 years after the invasion, two of Indonesia's most vocal critics were elevated to international status. East Timorese activists, Bishop Carlos Felipe Jimenez Belu and José Ramos Horta, received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1996. The award sent shockwaves through Jakarta, Washington, and into the corridors of Wall Street. The East Timor massacre is just one of many police state policies carried out under Suharto. Dispatching the military to these independence-minded regions was justified as necessary to halt communism during the 1970s. The idea that most rebellions were driven by a desperate desire to shake off the yoke of Suharto's repressive regime, and that the rebels turned to countries like China only as a last resort for military and medical assistance, was ignored by the mainstream U.S. press. Also ignored by the media was the fact that bolstering Suharto served the corporatocracy's interests. Suharto's determination to control the entire archipelago, even regions that did not possess coveted resources, was taken very seriously by both Washington and Wall Street. The corporatocracy understood that it had to support the dictator's grandiose vision of a united Indonesia if it wanted to enjoy a free reign over areas that possessed the resources it craved. On the northern tip of Sumatra, in oil and gas-rich Aceh province, more than 10,000 people have been killed by the military since the time I lived in Indonesia. Thousands more died in clashes in the Molucca Islands, West Kalimantan, Borneo, and Irian Jaya, New Guinea. In case after case, the true objective of the armed forces was to secure resources coveted by multinational corporations that, in essence, funded Suharto's government. Although oil and other mineral extracting companies took the lead, they were joined by a wide variety of corporations that benefited from Indonesia's cheap labor, natural resources, and markets for development projects and consumer goods. Indonesia is a prime example of an economy built around investment by the international banking and commercial communities. Backed by the promise of paying off loans through its resources, it went deep into debt to finance infrastructure projects that in turn generated demand for hotels, restaurants, shopping malls, and the construction, service, banking, and transportation activities that accompany these. Wealthy Indonesians and foreigners gained, while the majority of Indonesians suffered. Resistance movements were beaten back by the armed forces. Like the people, Indonesia's environment suffered severely. Mines, pulp and paper factories, and other resource-exploiting industries denuded enormous areas of one of the world's largest rainforests. Rivers were clogged with toxic wastes. The air around industrial sites and cities was laden with pollution. In 1997, Southeast Asia made world headlines when it was covered in a haze of noxious smoke generated by out-of-control forest fires in Indonesia, the consequence of EHM-induced corruption.